Blog Talk Radio.
This is a news in brief from the United Nations. The UN's top human rights official has condemned the imprisonment of Myanmar State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi and called for her release. Ms. Suu Kyi was convicted of incitement and breaking COVID-19 rules. She also faces charges of corruption and electoral fraud. The development follows reports that a military vehicle slammed into demonstrators in the city of Yangon over the weekend, leaving an unknown number injured. In a statement on Monday, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, maintained that Ms. Suu Kyi's guilty verdict was a result of a sham trial in secretive proceedings. The military-controlled court had been politically motivated, said Ms. Bachelet, who warned that the state councillor's detention had closed yet another door to political dialogue. Myanmar's military took power in a coup on 1 February after declaring the results of the November 2020 elections invalid. More than 10,000 political prisoners are believed to have been detained, and at least 175 have reportedly died in custody, according to the UN Human Rights Office. A major aid funding shortfall in Ethiopia threatens to leave millions of hungry Ethiopians and refugees without urgent nutrition assistance, the World Food Programme warned on Monday. The UN agency said that it now has a funding gap of $579 million to deliver life-saving assistance and livelihood support to 12 million people in Ethiopia over the next 6 months. More than $300 million is urgently needed to help 3.7 million people in northern Ethiopia, where conflict has raged for more than a year between central government forces and their allies and Tigrayan fighters. In a statement, WFP said that it was working with the government and others to alleviate the country's hunger crisis, but that it was struggling to do so. It blamed the extended combined effects of conflict, drought, flooding, desert locust invasions, market disruptions and high food prices, along with the COVID-19 pandemic, for leaving some 13.6 million people food insecure. Interruptions to malaria treatment caused by the COVID-19 pandemic caused considerable increases in infections and deaths, without leading to the doomsday scenario that many feared, the World Health Organization said on Monday. According to latest data, disruptions in the delivery of malaria services contributed to 14 million cases and 69,000 deaths. Two-thirds of these additional deaths were linked to disruptions in malaria prevention, diagnosis, and treatment during the pandemic. The WHO report highlighted a 27% reduction in incidence of malaria from the turn of the century to 2020, with an overall downward trend in deaths from the disease from 2000 to the present day. Africa remains the world's malaria epicenter, with 96% of deaths in 2020 and about 95% of global infections. Mihika Acharya, UN News.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department sued Texas over its heavily gerrymandered political maps, charging Republican lawmakers drew new districts that favor white voters despite the rapid growth of Black and Latinx communities in Texas. Associate Attorney General Vinita Gupta said Monday the new maps show clear signs of discrimination.
Texas will gain two new congressional seats because of its population growth, almost all of which is due to growth in the state's minority population. However, Texas has designed both of those new seats to have white voting majorities. The congressional plan also deliberately reconfigured a West Texas district to eliminate the opportunity for Latino voters to elect a representative of their choice. This is the third time in three decades where Texas has eliminated a Latino electoral opportunity in this same district, despite previous court determinations that this violates the law.
This comes a month after the Justice Department sued Texas over its recently passed voter suppression law, saying it illegally targets Texans of color, voters who don't speak English, and voters with disabilities. New York City will require all private employers to mandate their workers get vaccinated against COVID-19 by December 27th with no testing option as an alternative. It's the most aggressive vaccine mandate yet by any state or big city in the U.S. Mayor Bill de Blasio said the mandate could help prevent a winter surge of new infections.
I describe the actions we're taking today as a preemptive strike
get ahead of this problem before it deepens and use the thing that works, vaccination.
Nearly 90% of New York City adult residents have at least one vaccine dose, a higher rate than the national average. This comes as COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and deaths continue to rise rapidly nationwide. The official U.S. death toll from the pandemic is now on pace to pass 800,000 by the end of the year. President Joe Biden's meeting today with Russian President Vladimir Putin amidst growing tensions over Russia's buildup of estimated over 100,000 troops along its border with Ukraine. The Biden administration says it's responding by sending reinforcements to NATO allies in Eastern Europe. On Monday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the U.S. was prepared to sanction Russia if it launches an invasion of Ukraine.
On financial sanctions, we have consulted significantly with our allies and believe we have a path forward that would impose significant and severe harm on the Russian economy. You can call that a threat. You can call that a fact. You can call that preparation, whatever you want to call it.
Russian officials deny they're planning an invasion of Ukraine. A Kremlin spokesperson Monday called U.S.-Russia relations ahead of Biden's meeting with Putin, quote, quite lamentable. Meanwhile, Russia and India on Monday pledged greater military cooperation as President Putin met with Prime Minister Narendra Modi in New Delhi. Modi agreed to purchase Russian-made surface-to-air missiles, and the pair signed a contract for India to manufacture more than 600,000 Kalashnikov assault rifles. The Biden administration threatened to sanction India over its growing military ties with Russia. In Haiti, another three of the 17 North American missionary hostages taken in October have been released. Christian Aid Ministries says the three freed members are safe and in good spirits. A Haitian gang claimed responsibility for the kidnapping and had threatened to kill the hostages if their ransom was not paid. 12 people remain in captivity. In related news, internal documents have revealed the Homeland Security Administration's Civil Rights Office in late August advised immigration and border enforcement officials not to mass deport Haitian asylum seekers, warning the expulsions could be a violation of U.S. civil and human rights obligations. That's according to BuzzFeed, which reports the civil rights officers were ultimately ignored. Since September, advocates estimate the Biden administration's deported some 9,200 Haitians, setting off condemnation from even U.N. human rights officials. In more immigration news, the Biden administration Monday restarted the contested Trump-era Remain in Mexico program. Since its implementation in 2019, the policy, formerly known as the MPP, or Migrant Protection Protocols, forced tens of thousands of asylum seekers to wait in Mexico while their cases were resolved in U.S. courts. Earlier this year, a federal judge ordered the Biden administration to revive the program, but immigrant justice advocates are denouncing Biden's government for choosing to expand those who are eligible to include asylum seekers from the entire Western Hemisphere, which includes Haitians. The group Human Rights First has tracked over 1,500 reports of murder, torture, rape, and other attacks against asylum seekers forced to remain in Mexico. This is an asylum seeker from Honduras who's been stuck in an encampment in the Mexican border city of Reynosa.
I have been here for 4 months in the Plaza de las Americas, where the migrant camp is located. All we ask for is help. We want to leave, and we have suffered a lot. There are many sick children. We are in danger. We are afraid because we feel unsafe here.
We'll have more on that story later in the broadcast. The Biden administration has accelerated the expansion of new oil and gas wells in the United States, issuing drilling permits on public lands at a faster pace than under President Trump. That's according to a new report by Public Citizen, which found Bureau of Land Management has approved an average of 333 oil and gas drilling permits per month under Biden, 40% faster than it did in the first 3 years of Trump's presidency. This comes despite a campaign promise Biden made during a 2020 debate with Bernie Sanders.
No more drilling on federal lands. No more drilling, including offshore. No ability for the oil industry to continue to drill, period.
Meanwhile, a new study finds the world's biggest fossil fuel companies have made $174 billion in profits during the first 9 months of 2021. CNN reports a top aide to former Vice President Mike Pence is cooperating with a House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. Mark Short was Pence's chief of staff and was present when Pence was rushed out of the Senate chamber and moved to a secure location in the Capitol basement as rioters chanted, "Hang Mike Pence," breaching the building. Donald Trump reportedly banned Short from the White House immediately after the insurrection. Meanwhile, California Republican Congress member Devin Nunes said Monday he's quitting Congress by the end of the year in order to become CEO of the Trump Media and Technology Group. Donald Trump said in October the new company will compete with social media giants like Twitter and Facebook that have banned him from their platforms. Nunes formerly served as chair of the House Intelligence Committee, where he helped to stymie investigations into Russia's role in the 2016 election. In Chicago, actor Jussie Smollett testified in his criminal trial Monday, where he denied orchestrating a fake hate crime on himself and said the attack was not a hoax. Smollett was arrested in 2019, accused of lying to the Chicago police about being violently assaulted on the street. Police believe Smollett, who is gay and African American, paid two brothers who were personal acquaintances of Smollett's to carry out a staged attack. The former star in Fox's hit TV show Empire is facing six counts of felony disorderly conduct and up to 3 years in prison if convicted. In North Carolina, an animal rights advocate has been convicted on felony charges of burglary and larceny for removing a sick baby goat from a goat meat farm. Wayne Shen was given a suspended sentence and 24 months probation. The co-founder of the animal rights organization Direct Action Everywhere was arrested in 2018 for taking the baby goat from the Suspiro Goat Ranch in Pisgah Forest. Shen said the goat was suffering from pneumonia and had lice. His action was broadcast on social media as animal rights advocates often film these public animal rescues from farms where the animals face cruel and unsafe conditions. The Justice Department has ended its latest investigation into the murder of Emmett Till without filing any charges. Till was the 14-year-old black teenager who was brutally abducted, tortured, and killed in Mississippi in 1955 after he allegedly whistled at Carolyn Bryant Dunham, a white woman and store clerk. Federal prosecutors opened their latest probe after a 2017 book quoted Dunham as saying she lied when she said Till made sexual advances towards her. But the Justice Department said Monday it had insufficient evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt Dunham lied to the FBI. Till's family said they were deeply disappointed by the decision to drop the case. Dunham's husband and his half-brother were tried for Till's murder and acquitted by an all-white jury. The two later confessed to beating and shooting Till in a magazine article. Till's mother, Mamie Till Mobley, described her decision to have an open casket and show her son's mutilated body at his funeral. This is a clip from the 2005 film The Untold Story of Emmett Lewis Till.
Well, I looked at Mr. Rayner, and Mr. Rayner wanted to know, was I going to have the casket opened? I said, oh, yes, we're going to open the casket. He said, well, Miss Bradley, do you want me to do something for the face? Want me to try to fix it up? I said, no, let the people see what I've seen.
If he had lived, Emmett Till would have celebrated his 80th birthday in July. And the world-renowned political dissident, linguist, and author Noam Chomsky turns 93 years old today. We recently had a chance to speak to him at his home in Tucson, Arizona, and I asked him about what gives him hope as he turns 93.
I hope that the young people who are demonstrating in the streets of Glasgow, the mine workers who are in the United States who are agreeing to a transition program to sustainable energy, many others like them, I hope that they will be in the ascendancy and can take the measures that are feasible and available to create a much better world than the one we have and the one that the people of the world deserve.
Noam Chomsky will join us tonight in a special virtual event as we celebrate Democracy Now!'s 25th anniversary. We will speak with Noam along with Angela Davis, Martina Spada, Winona LaDuke, Arundhati Roy, plus the two Dannys, that's Danny Glover and Danny DeVito. The event will also feature musical performances by Lila Downs and Tom Morello. The virtual celebration begins at 8 p.m. Eastern. Go to democracynow.org for more details. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Did you catch that? Did you catch it? Amy Goodman threw you on there at 7 o'clock tonight. Yes, that's right, tonight, 7 o'clock. Well, you better go to democracynow.org. Yeah, you better go to democracynow.org to get that time. Tonight, a galaxy of celebrants of the 25th anniversary of Democracy Now! Tonight. Check it out. Coming up, Counterspin with Janine Jackson. Got some good stuff. The headlines, the news behind the headlines from the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR.org. Coming up next. And then in the second hour, John Grant will join us on our Tuesday. This can't be happening. Tuesday is below freezing in North Jefferson County, Kansas. The northeast part of Kansas is cold. Got one more night below freezing, and then we'll be up to like 70 degrees in a week.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as the year ends, it's hard not to think back on how it started with the incredible violent assault on the Capitol by a crowd seeking to prevent the declaration of Joe Biden as president. We talked with organizer and strategist Dorothy Benz the next day about the import of January 6th. While response to the insurrection has come slowly, states are cracking down on peaceful protests. We talked about that with the ACLU's Vera Eidelman around the 4th of July. That's today on Counterspin. People saw for themselves the boggling scenes, crowds of Trump supporters storming the halls of Congress, busting into offices, yelling for lawmakers to come out, trying, minimally, to disrupt the ceremonial electoral count declaring Joe Biden president. But the story is being shaped by news media in subtle and unsubtle ways. Will media act to report and investigate and challenge and demand as though they really understood those connections? Confronted with such boundary breaking in multiple senses, many people will want to hear that it was just a small fringe group of zealots abetted by a few law enforcement bad apples in service to an aberrational individual president who's anyway on his way out. Will corporate media sell the story that things got scary for a minute, but belief in the system is the way to safety? Joining us now is political scientist Dorothy Benz, a writer, organizer, and strategist. She has many years of work in frontline struggles here in the U.S. She joins us by phone from Brooklyn. Welcome back to Counterspin, Dorothy Benz.
It's great to be here.
Well, my brain at first sort of went to language. You know, is protester the best label when the target is the democratic process? Is chaos the most evocative description for a planned and predicted action with some measure of evident official sanction? Now I'm reading unprepared. Everyone was unprepared. But there are deeper questions about corporate media's role here. Just to throw a dart, while they've recently begun to qualify it, elite media spent years referring matter-of-factly to voter fraud, despite its virtual non-existence, because they simply had to suggest a Democratic equivalent to evidence of Republican voter suppression, lest they be accused of bias. So the idea that you can just declare fraud without evidence has been well established by the press itself. That's one of the things I'm thinking of. What are some of the things that are coming to your mind as you look at this early stages coverage?
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is Masha Gessen's warning 4 years ago after Trump was elected when they said, believe the autocrat. And in the intervening four-plus eternal years, as the left and as Black Lives Matter activists and immigrant rights advocates have raised the alarm over and over again about rising political violence, about the profoundly anti-democratic, racist policies of the administration, we have been called alarmists. We have been told it's not that bad. We have been told, you know, basically to calm down. And we could see this coming, as could anybody actually who's been on social media for the last 3 or 4 weeks. This violent piece of insurrection was planned openly on encrypted channels. I saw yesterday on Twitter, there was merch. There were people in T-shirts that said Civil War, January 6th, 2021. So unprepared and surprised is the last thing that anyone should have been, whether that's the Capitol Police or the media covering this story.
Absolutely. Well, many people have noted, you know, refused to deny, you could say, that everything would have been different yesterday from beginning to end, including before yesterday, as you're noting, if these people were black or were brown or were disabled, you know, really anything but what they were. I would add that that would extend beyond the day. You know, had these been black people, there would be real world lasting repercussions for all black people, right? And if you complained, anyone would need to say would be like 1-6-21, man, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The point is, talking about how differently they would have been treated if they were black, say, it's not a rhetorical exercise. It's not a game of what if. You know, that contrast is really the story, right?
It is, and it goes well beyond the obvious. I mean, so obvious that even some of the mainstream media has noted it, that Black Lives Matter activists would have been treated differently, that, you know, a Native Americans defending their land and their legal rights who were water hosed in sub-freezing temperatures at Standing Rock were treated differently, that activists who were just begging their senators not to kill them by eliminating their health care were ripped out of wheelchairs and thrown in handcuffs. I mean, yes, those are the obvious differences as opposed to the kid glove treatment that the white nationalists got yesterday. But the deeper problem is really the entire white nationalist project that, you know, as you alluded to in the introduction, this whole venture rests on. The fact that the police were so-called unprepared, I saw that word several times in the media coverage, it's not that they were unprepared, it's that they were prepared for white nationalists, which to them is not a crisis in the same way that black people demanding rights is, or that people insisting that public health care and national health care should be a thing. The problem goes much deeper there, and it is both a problem of how we have governed and a problem of how the police and the military have been central to white supremacy. Structurally, foundationally, ideologically, the function of the police has always been to defend the system as it exists, and the system is a white supremacist system. The ruling power started 500 years ago with settler colonizers. It went on to include genocide, slavery, strike breaking in the more modern capitalist era. It has never included defending democracy. That is a central understanding of how the police work. They weren't overwhelmed, you know. They knew. They just didn't think it was a problem.
I can't keep playing that imagine if game because I'm really thinking every black candidate forever would be side-eyed, you know, by the media. So if you don't win, are your people gonna riot? We know that you all don't really believe in democracy. I don't think media, as oh my gosh, as they are right now, I don't think they're really taking on board the counterfactual that they're sort of thinking about. And then more cynically, I sort of think, in contrast, there won't be the same kind of repercussions for people who not just look like the insurrectionists from yesterday, but who think like them, you know, except that maybe media might seek them out, you know, to say, you're the good Trump dead-ender, you know. You know, what makes you tick? Why didn't you storm the Capitol?
Yeah, I saw a comment this morning from Ben Ehrenreich, who was talking about the media label of a mob, right, reaching for sort of a classist term instead of calling them fascist or neo-Nazi or racist or white supremacist, and not calling them just protesters because, rightly, they were trying to differentiate between, let's say, Black Lives Matter or healthcare protesters, but not going for the term that's really there.
It is difficult to grapple with the language around here. We're in kind of new territory, but what we do see is an unwillingness to use the terms white nationalist, to use white supremacist in connection with this kind of thing. And I think it is part of media's desire to splinter people off, to say this really is a fringe and discourage the connections between these people and, in fact, the mainstream of the Republican Party and of many U.S. institutions.
I think that is absolutely right. There's kind of two things going on there in that I would call it a soothing effort to make this not a bigger problem, right? The larger problem is not contextualizing it in white supremacy. The larger problem is not admitting that the entire American project is a white supremacist project. You know, the media did point some fingers at Donald Trump yesterday, rightly, but they seem to exempt almost wholly the entire rest of the Republican Party. This morning on the New York Times' homepage, at least on the app, they had a bunch of quotes, and they were all from Republicans, making them look really principled, you know, Graham, McConnell, and Loeffler saying, you know, well, this isn't the right thing to do, as if these people hadn't been feeding this same right-wing monster for the last 4 years, not to mention the last 4 weeks.
Right.
So that's, like, one way in which the media is trying to create a respectable-looking set of Republicans in the middle of what is not that. The other is not talking about the larger shift here, which is the assault on democratic norms and the assault on democracy itself, which has moved from sort of a cloaked phase, you know, voter ID laws that we pretend are just about voter fraud or that are somehow, you know, facially neutral or whatever, mass incarceration, which, you know, disenfranchises and create second-class citizenship for, you know, millions and millions of people, moving away from that cloaked phase to this really overt phase and kind of testing what works. Like, well, let's throw some lawsuits at it. Let's try that. Let's try to, like, directly shake down some officials and threaten them. Okay, let's try that. You know, in October, Representative Mike Lee floated the term rank democracy, you know, as if there is such a thing as too much democracy. Like, you know, don't let the unwashed actually vote. And that's exactly what it is. And that is actually both a point of continuity and discontinuity with the entire American project. It has never been a country that is a democracy, a true democracy, in the sense of a universal franchise, let alone economic and social democracy. But it has pretended for a long time that it is. And what the right is doing now is testing even that pretense, see how they can proceed. And that is a genuine fascist threat.
And that's the danger of portraying this as marginal or fringe or failed, right? Portraying it as a failed attempt because, as you and others have said, that failure doesn't mean the end of it.
No, absolutely not. I mean, yes, I've seen a couple of headlines about, like, well, Trump's on his way out anyway. And, you know, this morning as I was listening to NPR, the reporter or the anchor said, well, what did they think they would accomplish? You know, like they were talking about some kids on a playground. And it's not, you know, that they failed at overturning the election. It's that they succeeded in mainstreaming fascism and fascist tactics. That's really the point, and I haven't seen that anywhere in the mainstream media coverage. You know, similarly on New York One, or in a New York One tweet, I should say, to be exact, somebody was talking about how the property damage this morning was actually quite minimal. Yeah, it might be minimal, although, you know, when property damage happens at a Black Lives Matter protest, you would think it was a matter of national security. But I responded to that tweet by saying that's besides the point. The assault isn't on, you know, Capitol Hill property, it's on democracy itself. And that really has not been enough of the focus. As a matter of fact, in a general kind of a way, this is a continuity from the entire Trump era where media have gone out of their way to normalize fascist tactics and trying to squeeze them, you know, square peg in a round hole kind of a style into the box of normal political imagery, where they describe something like they had a headline yesterday before all this went down. With objection to election results, Hawley puts his party in a bind, you know. So they turned this over anti-democratic effort to overturn an election into an intra-party, you know, political quandary, thus normalizing what is not normal or what should not be normal in an allegedly democratic society.
Well, let me just kind of ask you finally, in a real way, corporate media's deepest role here is as champions of the capitalist neoliberal system that creates the real grievances that are weaponized and combined with, you know, white supremacist ideology. Doesn't create the white supremacy, but it drives those grievances that then become so combustible. And for the lesson, therefore, from yesterday to be, don't push for real social change because that's fighting, you know, and that leads to violence, you know, for the lesson to be, now both sides, both, you know, people who bust into the Capitol and Black Lives Matter and, you know, AOC, you know, that balancing. Let's have civility. Let's have color blindness. Let's look forward and not back. If media come out of the gate and that's the message, I feel like that's almost the most dangerous thing that could happen.
It is the most dangerous thing that could happen. If you just shift the language a little bit and you imagine them saying, you know, anti-fascists really need to reach across the aisle and be in a spirit of bipartisanship with the fascists, well, then you would get the problem, right? But, and that is exactly the problem. You know, part of it is the media habit, the very bad habit of pretend objectivity that puts everything in a he said frame, even when one set of claims is factually demonstrable and the other set is demonstrably untrue, and, you know, pretending that those things are equivalent, but also just on the surface pretending that being neutral in the face of a fascist threat is an acceptable journalistic value. It's not.
We've been speaking with writer, organizer, and strategist Dorothy Benz. You can follow her on Twitter at DrBenz3. Dorothy Benz, thank you for joining us this week on Counterspin.
It's my pleasure.
What do the freedoms we tell ourselves define this country and its project actually mean in 2021? If you think the answers are to be found in history, you might be missing the point. The U.S. is engaged in radical, to-the-root debate right now about what democracy means, what civil liberties mean, and what kind of society we want to live in. We're in history right now. This is what it looks like. So what are the front burner issues in terms of free speech, rights of assembly, the right to protest, to disrupt business as usual, which we know is central to making actual change? Our next guest thinks about these questions every day. Vera Eidelman is staff attorney with the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Vera Eidelman.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I wanted to talk first about BL versus Mahanoy Area School District. I know that many listeners haven't heard anything about this case, but it really gets at when do you lose your right to free speech or free expression? Can you talk a little bit about what was at stake in that case and your response to the court's ruling?
Absolutely. So Mahanoy Area School District versus BL was the most important case about young people's free speech rights in the last 50 or so years. The issue at stake in that case was a school's authority to discipline a student for what they said or expressed outside of school hours, off of school property, that was not harassing or threatening in any way. Our client in that case, BL, was, when the case began, a 14-year-old who had tried out for the varsity cheerleading team at her public school. She unfortunately didn't make it onto varsity and was very upset. And she took to Snapchat on a weekend at a local convenience store with her friend, not wearing anything that reflected the school, not mentioning the school or anyone at the school by name, instead typing F school, F softball, F cheer, F everything, on top of a photograph of her and her friend raising their middle fingers. They did not say F, they used the actual word, just for clarity.
Right.
And the school suspended her from the cheerleading squad for the entire year. And the ACLU of Pennsylvania took up her case arguing that the school could not discipline her under the diminished rules that attach to student speech rights inside of the school environment, given that she was out of school speaking her mind on the weekend online. And the Supreme Court ultimately agreed with us, holding that the school cannot apply the same diminished rule that attaches inside of school, outside of school, because otherwise students would be carrying the schoolhouse on their back 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, unable to ever fully explore their views, unable to fully express themselves for fear of always worrying that they might be deemed, quote unquote, disruptive, which is the standard that typically applies in schools. And the court also recognized that the school itself actually has an interest in enabling students to engage in dissenting and unpopular speech, recognizing, of course, that what that means in any particular school district will vary by the reality of that school district, because the school really is, in the words of Justice Breyer, a nursery for democracy. And one of the goals of the school should be to teach kids what it means to have free speech rights.
And as a parent with an activist child, I hear that word disruptive, and it just sets something off, because obviously that is a contextual term, as you've just described. But that sounds a little worrisome just on its face at the level of language to make that the standard.
Absolutely. That was the main thing that we were very worried about in this case, that the school might win in arguing that it can apply that very subjective viewpoint-based standard outside of the school.
Well, so, okay, schools are nurseries to help kids develop their voice and to learn that they are allowed to use their voice, and in terms of using it meaningfully in terms of changing things. So then those young people become adults, you know, and they want to go out in the street to use their voice. So now we're at my second question, which is this spate, not new but increasing, of anti-protest legislation. Can you just talk about the range of laws that we're seeing spring up and what they are doing or trying to do?
Yes, unfortunately, we have, as you mentioned, seen the continuation and deepening of the anti-democratic, anti-protest legislative trend around the country. For at least the last 5 years now, we have seen legislators respond to vocal, powerful, full-throated advocacy, not by listening to what their constituents are saying, but instead by seeking to create new laws that would silence them. So examples of the types of laws range from increasing penalties on laws that already make something criminal. So for example, laws that already criminalize trespass or refusal to disperse or failure to obey an officer. All of those things are already illegal, and these laws would seek to increase the penalties that attach. In some cases, the bills seek to increase the penalties, not just in terms of criminal time, which of course is incredibly impactful, but also in terms of restricting people's access to public employment, to public office, and even to public benefits. Things like access to scholarships for school, food stamps, and the like. In addition, some of these laws seek to really punish not unlawful conduct, but association, the fact that people are in the same place at the same time. A number of the bills that have been proposed, including some even that have passed, for example, in Florida, are incredibly ambiguous as to whether they punish an individual who has themselves engaged in violence or property destruction, for example, or every other person around when that occurs, regardless of whether they were involved, regardless of what they themselves think of that conduct. So we're really seeing a lot of bills, and even a few bills that have become law, that seek to criminalize association, criminalize the fact of gathering together to make our voices heard.
I think if I could pick out one thing, the idea of laws that say it's okay to hit protesters with your car. You know, I just think that even for folks who, you know, may have complicated feelings, that's just mind-blowing. What's going on with that?
I completely agree, and I think it's particularly mind-blowing given that these aren't just hypotheticals. We know that Heather Heyer died in Charlottesville as a result of someone hitting her with his car. We've also seen many other protesters injured at protests by cars, and so I think it is a particularly perverse legislative trend that we are seeing, and a clear message that it sends to people who are thinking of joining with others and going out onto the streets is you better think twice, because you might get hit by a car, and if you are, you might have no recourse.
Exactly, exactly. Well, let me ask you finally about media, because I often have noticed that, you know, broadly speaking, corporate media love people speaking up, you know, until they're an organized group and they're speaking up in the street, and then somehow they move from being individuals with a voice to interested activists, and it's somehow different. You know, it's like, protest is great, but keep it quiet, you know. And I see, like, NPR, which has done all kinds of favorable coverage, but then I see this headline, wave of anti-protest bills, and anti-protest is in quotes, like maybe it's not true, wave of anti-protest bills could threaten First Amendment. Well, could and threaten, now we're at 2 degrees of separation. And I just wonder if media are bringing home the threat that's happening here. So that's just me, but I would like to ask you, what would you like to see more of, maybe, from reporters, or maybe less of, in terms of coverage of this legislation, coverage of the protests, and coverage of the real fight that we're in right now?
That's an interesting question. I do think that one thing to keep in mind is that this really is an anti-democratic trend.
Right.
I think there are ways in which it will not be surprising to see who these laws get applied against, but at the same time, at their core, they are taking aim at, you know, where you started, one of our fundamental American rights, the right to protest. And that applies regardless of the message that is being expressed. And I think it's important to keep in mind that this is legislation that will impact people regardless of what they're expressing, simply because they are seeking to do what is so deeply American, to join together and speak out together and be in the same place with other people who they want to associate with. And I think that that is the thing that legislators should really be shamed for doing, the idea that they are trying to stop people from exercising one of their fundamental rights.
We've been speaking with Vera Eidelman. She's staff attorney with the ACLU's Speech Privacy and Technology Project. They are online at ACLU.org. Vera Eidelman, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group. We're online at FAIR.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
What a difference a day made, 24 little hours, brought the sun and the flowers, where there used to be rain. My yesterday was blue, dear, today I'm part of you, dear, my lonely nights are through, dear, since you said you were mine. What a difference a day made. There's a rainbow before me, skies above can't restore me. Since that moment of bliss, that thrilling kiss, it's heaven when you find romance on your menu. What a difference a day makes, and the difference is you.
That was 1934, broadcast normally over the BBC, or the equivalent at that time, or, you know, that was when the roundups began, mass arrests, the Nazis had successfully pulled off their coup d'etat, March 1933. In 1934, Harry Roy and his Bat Boys, and as well as most of the listening audience at that time, were probably staring at the prospect of World War II long before the United States was. Coming up in the second hour, top of the hour, we'll be attempting to get our co-host on, John Grant, longtime contributor to This Can't Be Happening Radio, on Tuesdays. John has done this show with me for years. Hope you enjoy it. We'll take a music more. Harry Roy. Sometimes there. He's very whimsical sometimes. very unusual band, considering the historical context.
Can't believe that it's you.
somehow. Oh, baby, you're nobody's sweetheart now.
Do the discounter, the Italian discounter. It's just the cutest dance because you don't advance, you just retreat.
You just retreat.
When the music goes tender, you prepare to surrender. You simply turn about, throw up your hands and shout retreat.
You just retreat.
Ha! One step forward, that's the way to attack. Three steps backwards, because it's better going back. Won't you try the Toscana? Come on, don't give a darn. It's just the cutest dance, because you don't advance, you just retreat.
You just retreat.
You can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me.
You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to...
Radio Free Kansas.
You have to let it all go. Fear, doubt, and disbelief. Free your mind.
probably nothing more boring. Probably nothing more boring than to hear that bump music. But I think we have John Grant on the line, and he has the only existing hard copy of the New York Times in his hands. All kinds of news to discuss. It's we've got up to a grand total of 32 degrees Fahrenheit here in beautiful, dreary old Kansas, and we're expecting a 22 degree low tomorrow morning, and it warms up. In 7 days, supposed to be 70 degrees.
Go figure. Climate change. We're probably in the low 40s today. It's not that bad. But it was like yesterday, my wife's birthday was 67. And then it went down to 20s, in the 20s tonight, last night. So it's whipping around. It's amazing.
Yeah, it is. Well, I don't know. There's all kinds of news to discuss. You, in our green room talk, you talked about Georgia. You sort of got to think about Georgia.
Georgia, to me, Georgia is really happening. Pardon?
Go ahead. I'm listening.
No, Georgia is really happening. It's what's this fella Purdue? Where's the story here? He's the guy that lost his Senate seat to Ossoff, I think his name is. And he is now decided. He's a very Trump guy. Obviously, Trump is the only way he feels he can get anywhere anymore. So he is now running against Kemp, the governor who beat Stacey Abrams for governor. And Stacey Abrams, of course, is running. And so Purdue, where's that story? Purdue had made the statement yesterday that he was, here he is, that he purposely named Stacey Abrams. The whole thing was to stop Stacey Abrams. And I don't know if people know who Stacey Abrams is, but she's a black woman who was a state legislator, and then she ran for governor, and she's a total fireball. She has started an organization to support improvements in democracy, to, because they have, the Republicans have started some laws in Georgia to restrict black votes, et cetera. So she's got a well-oiled institution that's focused on that. She's published two books lately since she lost, she lost the governorship. One of them is a novel that was treated quite well about the Supreme Court. And the other one is about election. The other one is about election issues. My wife is reading that right now. I got it at a bookstore for like a buck and a half the other day. Anyway, so that's Georgia's really exciting. And so this guy, David Perdue, and of course he's going to run in the primary against Brian Kemp, who Donald Trump had a vendetta against and kind of hates Brian Kemp for some reason. And they want to just get rid of him as much as they can. So they have this very volatile primary between Perdue and Kemp. And it was interesting. To me, it was almost the desperation of it was really amazing that he said, I am running to stop Stacey Abrams. In other words, they're so scared of someone like Stacey Abrams, who's a very capable woman leader, who is, engaged in a lot of successful organizing and politics in Georgia. It's I think, a really interesting act of desperation that this guy Purdue is, like, running. And he mentioned her name, like, three or four times, you know. Usually they don't mention their opponent's names, you know, to give them any credit, right? You know, mention yeah. my, just spell the name right, you know, all that stuff. Well, he, you know, they're elevating Stacey Abrams up to this incredible level. And so we'll see what happens, because to me, Georgia, you know, they just lost the two Senate seats that put the U.S. Senate into the 50-50 range, you know, with this, and they own Senate with the vice president's vote. And, you know, you look at Georgia, and you have to recognize that Georgia, of course, is one of the deep South states with, you know, horrible racism and history in the past. But it's also got Atlanta, which is, you know, I love Atlanta. I've been there many times. And it's just a huge, modern, cosmopolitan, sophisticated city, dead center in the middle of the deep South. But it's, you know, it's an airport hub for you know, half right. or, you know, certainly the swatch of the eastern Midwest part of the country in the South, the huge airport. And so you, if you look at the Republicans and the Democrats as fights between, you know, kind of urbanism and cosmopolitanism and sophistication and all that kind of stuff versus rural and sparsely populated areas around the country, you know, you have both of that in Georgia, but you have this huge, huge anchor city there that, you know, is very sophisticated. You know, I have a friend there who used to work for Julian Bond years and years ago, and he's very astute in politics down there, and, you know, and he lives in Atlanta. And so, I don't know, I just think Georgia is going to be really, next year, 2022, 2024, Georgia is going to be the hot spot. So I may go down there and visit my friend and sort of talk to him and see what's up.
Well, I'll probably keep you there, John, and you won't be able to escape and get back to Pennsylvania. But, well, you know, let's back up a little bit. I mean,
sure. Yeah.
What was it? You know, we got to remember, 2020 was a big year because, as you said, they gained two seats. Purdue,
yeah.
And what was her other, the woman?
I
the
forget
woman
the woman's name. She was kind of lightweight. Yeah.
Oh, no, she was not a light. I mean, I think no, both of these are big money. That was
uh-huh.
the thing that came
oh,
out, if I remember,
money.
Is that Purdue and Loughlin, well, her husband owns
Loughlin
Exchange. Yeah, Security Exchange Committee. Or, committee.
Right, exactly.
SEC, he owns it. He owns that, yeah. Her,
yeah.
She's married to that. And and Purdue, I can't remember, wasn't he accused of some sort of inside trading or something? I can't remember.
He did have an issue with that.
Stint.
But in these days, that doesn't
yeah,
seem
some
to,
sort of,
you know, you can
well,
like,
I
shoot
think
somebody
did. I think, both of these candidates at that time in 2020 were pretty detached. I mean, I'm not sure. I can't remember what Purdue was in. Was he in the Senate or the House? But Purdue, I mean,
he's a senator.
He
was
remember,
a U.S. senator. Purdue was
a senator. He was
a senator.
He gave it up. But, yeah, and he got thrown out of office, basically.
Absolutely.
And if I remember right, one of the reasons I think I can answer the mystery that you posited. I want to answer my
okay.
version of the
sure.
What I think the mystery is. Why Purdue is invoking the name of Stacey Abrams, like she's a witch or something.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well,
it's,
let's
it,
not forget that
black
she is
witch.
Black.
A,
you know,
a,
she
a
is
black
and
a black
in this
witch. Well, that's
age
horror.
Of you
black
know
witch.
Retrenchment of racism. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he's afraid of her more than the guy he. Who's running against? Oh yeah,
Brian Kemp, governor. Yeah,
Brian Kemp.
Yeah.
Right. Can't forget
right.
that. Right. I mean, Donnie doesn't like him, of course. And
Donnie are at each other's throat. Yeah.
Well, they were in bed together earlier, if you can imagine that. They loved each other up until.
Right. I know.
I think Brian Kemp, Governor Brian, has probably got cooties or something from Donnie and decided to get out of bed and go and tell everybody about how crooked he is. He got tired of those midnight phone calls. You know, Donnie wanted phone sex with him. I do not want phone sex with you, Donnie. Yeah.
Let me just finish.
They're scared of the black witch.
Absolutely.
They're scared of her. They're mortally scared of her. And that's not just because of two books that probably only left-wingers read and Democrats. Those two books don't mean anything to those guys.
Well, she's a hell of an organizer. That's the thing. She has incredible energy.
That's
she's brilliant.
They're scared the hell out of her. Or they're scared of her because she has teams at Canvas. And the number I heard that she brought out a critical election was for voting for them because they saw, she brought out 130,000 voters that heretofore had voted, and she's got a batting record of bringing voters out.
These imbeciles,
I mean, that's one thing that does scare them.
You talk about imbeciles.
That's what they're afraid of.
Yeah. You talk about imbeciles. This Kemp, he's very presentable, you know, with this racist position that he's taking to crush Stacey Abrams, trying to organize the Trump people in the state to come out against, you know, the progressive black candidate. But if you look at it, Tracy Abrams barely lost to Kemp. You know, remember the phone call to Raffensperger, all I need is 11,200 votes or something. That was the breakdown. They lost by 11,500 or something like that. And there was all sorts of, you know, Kemp was a Secretary of State himself, and they control these elections. So the argument was that Kemp set up the election system, you know, that accommodated those 11,000 votes that he got and cut down votes on the other side. So it's a real squeaker pretty much. And it was corruption on Kemp's part that tipped it to his side. Well, now if you have a hot primary, a very volatile, emotional primary, you know, with the Trumpies hating Kemp, they can really brutalize themselves in that primary. So say Kemp wins, how many Trumpy people just won't show up? Or if Perdue wins, all those people that didn't, you know, that were for Kemp and didn't like his nemesis Donald Trump, are they going to vote for Tracy Abrams, the Democrat? So, they could really split the Republicans between Trump and anti-Trumps and really lose. I mean, I could see a scenario where it comes out as quite a win on the part of Stacey Abrams. You know, who knows? I obviously don't know. I'm speculating.
Well, I want to believe that. I'm sorry.
So, you know, I don't know. Who knows? All I'm saying is going to be very, very interesting, you know.
Oh, yeah. We're talking about the 2022 elections.
Yeah.
For some reason, is Georgia, like, do they have earlier elections than you?
I don't understand. They're fiddling around with it so much that you don't know.
Yeah.
You know, they were the ones I think they had the rule that you can't give anybody water on the lines and all that. Yeah.
play games in Kansas.
You know, they limit the amount of polling places so that they have long lines, and you know, and you're not allowed to give water to people on the lines. You know, it's preposterous. You know, but this is the way they're doing
they make a hurdle, you know, an obstacle for it to get to the polls. This is 2021. The our primary in Kansas will not be till next August. Is early on if it's by Kansas.
Yeah.
Kansas voting schedule. If Georgia's anything like that, this thing's already heated up. You know,
I know. Well, and, that's the thing, and. If it's heated up now and it's going to have a heated campaign over the next virtual year, well, until August for the primary anyway, and then to November for the main election. So, you know, a lot of stuff can happen in all that time, and especially with them coming out so energetic now, it's almost like shot your wad early, you know, or something, you know.
Well, who knows what kind of controversy will brew up. I mean, they'll rat each other out. That's sort of the normal thing about primary.
Oh, it'll be ugly as ever.
So I think was it Tracy Abrams or Stacey Abrams? I think she has, as the black, she should continue with the role as the Black Witch, you know, and just tell them that they're
right. Yeah, I don't think she has to do anything much. She just is there.
Right.
She's the boogeyman, you know.
I think, it's sort of like Biden in the basement, you know. I mean, Well, I hope it's that way for the rest of the country, too, but I don't think it's going to. Here in Kansas, the League of Women Voters, a more venerable institution in the history of the Midwest, at least. I don't know about you guys. League of Women Voters. God, here in Kansas, they've shut down their operation. They're not registering voters. And because of these recent laws passed, saying that if you are, it's like you got to go to jail and or you got to get arrested and then take it to court to find out. But they're trying to arrest anybody who is perceived. Now that's not the actual word in there in the law that they wrote and passed.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something like if you're perceived as an election official, it's a felony. They can arrest you and put you in jail on a felony. And,
for what again? Tell me again. What?
If you're a league of if you're helping people register to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and if there's somebody who perceives who thinks you're an election official,
right,
then you can be charged. You can be charged with a felony.
For what?
For claiming you're a legal election official.
Oh, okay.
I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, that's exactly.
Yeah,
what
I don't know. A lot of this stuff is so new and so corrupt that you just don't know what they're capable of.
Think about it. I've been saying it may take some. I mean, the League of Women Voters is notorious, at least in Kansas. Table with some gray-haired women. I don't mean to be ageist. older ladies. You know. Most of the time, usually at both parties, who will sit there and help you register to vote. Well, they're not going to try to do that anymore. And there's other groups. A group I'm on the email list with called Loud Life, which is a more youth-oriented, and that's what they do. They're based out of the capital. They've also announced they're not registering voters. Now, I think that's a defeatist strategy. I think they could.
I mean, how can you outlaw registering voters? I don't get that.
People are really, especially Big D Democrats in Kansas, are very small d moralized. They're demoralized.
Right.
And such they become such a minority. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you know, that's and I know some of them listen to the show, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's, you know, that's pathetic. I think they should offer up some blood and flesh and bone. And some of them get arrested and protest.
Yeah,
stuff,
well,
you know, because
I think it has to come to that.
I can't do it. I'm not going to. I've thought about it. I can't do it. And one thing I wanted to suggest to these people, the demoralized Democrats in Kansas, is that they should, you know, they should just put up a, they should just have some buttons made or, hell, just a stick-on label. That they put on, go out and register people to vote, and have a label. Hello,
going
on there. Have a label on stuck on their blouse and say, I am not an election official. I am not an election official.
Mm-hmm.
And they go ahead and register people to vote. I mean, do you have problems like that of registering people to vote in Ben Franklin's Pennsylvania? Do you have problems registering the people to vote in Pennsylvania?
I'm not aware of that here. Again, but we're a purple or purple state, blue state. We don't have the retrograde personalities that you do in places like Kansas, you know.
Well, did the General Assembly or the Commonwealth or whatever kind of whatever they call it?
Right, the legislature,
The legislature, did it pass any laws this last session on
they talked about it.
They've
not done it like Texas and Kansas and other places have done it. No, I don't think so. Nothing to that degree. They're trying, certainly. But again, this is a very purple state. So who knows? It's just amazing. In the general idea of it, I just am still shocked that things are going the way they are. It's, you know, like this can't be happening, you know, and it is, you know.
There's no kidding. Now let's see. Let's shift. Is there anything in the New York Times about the big Biden Putin Zoom call today or anything like that? I mean, that's
are announcing it, and there's a lot of Putin news in here. Let me see. Where was that? I saw a whole page of Putin news. I just scanned it. I didn't read it all, but.
Well, we need this Vlad. I mean, we need to know Vlad's up to. I mean, Ukraine.
Ukraine's
is the big headline.
Oh, yeah, exactly. In call, Biden is expected to warn Putin. And it's across the page from the jump on the Ukraine story on the front page. It has these Russian guys in their barracks on Ukraine front wearily awaiting the worst. You know, he's got troops lined up on the border, and there's big photographs of all these 100? Russian troops, you know, with they're smiling, and they have all their guard gear on. And, so he's going to talk to Putin. I guess, what, is he talking to him now? Or, when? You know, I don't know when it is, but...
Any time today. I haven't checked the latest time.
Says here, President Biden is expected to encourage diplomatic de-escalation over the conflict in Ukraine when he speaks to Vladimir Putin in Russia in a video meeting on Tuesday, that's today. But Mr. Biden will warn Mr. Putin that if he orders the Russian forces poised at the border to invade Ukraine, Western allies may move to cut Russia off from the international financial system and seek direct sanctions on Mr. Putin's closest associates. You know, so you know, they're playing footsie and hardball, or I guess maybe a softball at this stage, with China about their Olympics. You know, we're not. I don't think they're doing a full Jimmy Carter. They're not doing a full Jimmy Carter, but they're. Yeah, it's some kind of diplomatic freeze-out or something.
It's just Blinken. It's Blinken, blinking, and Blinken is blinking and blinking the holiday season.
Right.
I mean, it's just that they're just, that, you know, that is not a hot point. That is just a sore point with these U.S. imperialists. You know, they've got to put on these shows, I guess, to the hall and keep us on the edge of our seat. Keep the Trump, the Trump supporters wired for sound, you know, ready to jump out with their AR-15s and go on another mass shooting spree. The nation, you got the Times, and you're trying to, you know, I've got the Nation. I got it listening to the Nation. It tries to be a weekly listener. And it does.
Right.
It does a great job. There was something I learned in an article that I don't think many Americans know, that first I'm going to give proper credit. It's a article by Anatole Levine, and it's Ukraine, the most dangerous problem in the world, and how to solve it. And there's a lot to the article. Let's just go to the Nation website. You can find it. It's their cover story for this week. And how to stop the bloodshed. There was something I did not know. There was a thing called the Minsk, M-I-N-S-K, I think that's a Minsk 2 protocol.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, where is that? Is that
Minsk, I guess, it's a city in Russia, I think, right?
Okay, all right. They have it was passed with EU support. Well, at least the leaders of France, Germany, Russia had already negotiated an agreement to resolve the problem in 2015. And with the Donbas conflict, that's roughly the geographic line that runs from north to south along the Crimea, and it's west of the Russian seaport, which is the reason they're doing all this. And there's a map in the Nation. It's very interesting. They've already negotiated. These are the big leaders, France, Germany, Russia. And what the fuck does the United States have to say about Ukraine anyhow, other than they want to turn it into a puppet for NATO? I mean, but there's a neat map, and it's very clear. Now, bear in mind, these leaders of these European countries that are neighbors, and they're the ones that really have the interest in this. They've already negotiated this, and it's like a 15-kilometer, that's in this area, wide buffer zone, and it has clearly laid out lines of control of this buffer zone. And it runs hundreds of miles or kilometers from the Black Sea all the way up north, and this is a real viable solution. It's already been done. I think it's just a bellicose. I hate to sound like a Russian stooge for Putin, but I think all this is all bullshit. This is just rattling, and they're playing a very dangerous game because Vlad the Impaler Putin has brought 175,000 troops. Along this to make his point, because the Ukraine is still bellicose, the Ukraine keeps bringing in the interests of NATO. So when you got Germany, which is in NATO, France, which is in NATO, France in NATO? You know, I think France is in NATO.
Is Poland? Yeah, of course
it is.
France, Poland? How about Poland? Is Poland in Hungary?
Yeah, Poland is. Poland's a suck-up. Poland is a suck-up. Yes, they're definitely.
It is kind of confusing. I mean, for instance, like the Cold War is supposed to be over, but alas, the legacy of it isn't. And, I mean, that's what all this is. You know, once the Soviet Union died, Gorbachev resigned and then passed it over to Yeltsin, all that, and all these the capitalists went over there and the gangster capitalists and created this gangster capitalist public-private system that Putin took over and, you know, is in the catbird seat, as we say, Ukraine is holding out in the, you know, war context. It's volatile, and you know, it's. Well, I mean, do the American people? Mike, I hear noises. Are you there? Okay. Hello.
You're not going to control the show. Okay. What are you doing there? Oh, listeners, I'm sorry. We got a little technological problem here going on. We got a guy in the green room wants to hijack the show, I think. Hey. Hey. Hold on.
Yeah.
Hey. What did you hang up for? I got a guy. I'm screening a guy in the green room.
Okay.
The caller. Sure. I'm sorry about that.
No problem.
For that, you get him. His name's Piaki. He wants to talk about World War II.
All right.
Let's see if I can get him back on. Let's see if we can get Piaki right. on. I left him in the green room when you hung up.
I didn't hang up.
I wonder why the phone disconnected. Your line disconnected.
I don't know. It must be it's Vladimir Putin or somebody. I don't know.
Yeah, right, yeah. Okay, so this is Piaki, and he wants to talk about World War II.
Yeah.
I was telling him we're talking about Ukraine. I said we want to talk about Ukraine. That's what we're talking about. And he said, shame on you to me. So let's see if we can. Are you still there, Piaki?
Well, really. Yeah, I did want to make mention.
You're on the air.
Yeah, I did want to make mention of the commemoration of World War II and that great, great, great American society that we probably won't see again. And there's not much on that. But, you know, here's another thing. You talk about the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the overthrow of Yanukovych back during the Obama administration. And Ukraine has been a problem for Russian factions for a long, long time. Matter of fact, you had a greater Holocaust in the Ukraine than anything that Israel experienced. But here's the thing, too. China has plans of putting a naval base on the coast of West Africa, which is just a little bit further than the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Huh? Who's going to put a base in Africa? China is colonizing Africa right now. Yeah.
Well, but that's on land. We're talking about a naval base on the west coast of Africa,
mm-hmm.
which is about, 3,000 miles from the United States.
Right.
Getting closer.
That has nothing to do with Cuba. My God, no.
No, it doesn't have anything to do with Cuba, but it's still close.
Well, Africa, I mean, oh my God, it's like 3,000 miles away. It's not 90 miles off our coast, and we don't have a history of, I mean, Africa is Africa, for God's sakes. It's, we've exploited Africa. My God, we bought thousands and thousands of slaves from Africa and things like that in history. And, you know, we have been involved in mucking around in Africa in many, many ways, as Europe did, colonizing. My God. I mean, look at the history, yeah.
Slavery was a free enterprise. It wasn't the United States built it. It was an enterprise.
That's a stew pot there. Why? Of course it was free private enterprise, yes.
And
obviously, the European world was exploiting it and pushing it, and yeah, no question.
Well, slavery was going on in Africa before there ever was a European world. Matter of fact, Africa taught the world slavery.
Obviously,
Portugal,
the United States. Yeah, we didn't create slavery. You're right. Yeah.
No, we didn't. We didn't. And the United States government technically didn't make no money off of slavery. That was all private enterprise, which was had by both whites and blacks. It was black slaveholders, Indian slaveholders. It was the thing of that
day.
Well,
okay. Well, that's true. There were certainly incidents like that. There's no question about it. But does that mean it's defensible? I don't understand what you're saying.
Well, to say if it's defensible is like saying that the people that involved them were breaking the law. They were not breaking laws. Right?
Well, you know, the Holocaust where they killed 6 million Jews, that was legal in Germany.
We're not talking about that. I'm a black
American. Yeah, but you're talking about
American.
Law here. You're talking about law and atrocity. And just because an atrocity was somehow overlooked by the legal system, you know, okay, granted, you're right, but that, you know, it's still.
Well,
it's
yes, we are right. The slaves that were brought here for a particular reason, not all, either expelled by the tribe they were coming from, the engagement that they were involved in, and like I said, that slavery wasn't nothing new to them that was caught up in it. And I'm a natural-born black American, and I think I can talk very eloquent on that.
So you're African-American?
Natural-born.
Okay, all right, okay. So I still don't quite understand your point. My point
was about China's plans,
mm-hmm.
as I read on some news media, that they're contemplating on having a large naval base there on the Guinea coast.
Right.
And if they're going to put one there, why not Venezuela?
Well, we do have the Monroe Doctrine. We went through the whole Cuban Missile Crisis over that stuff. You know, that's a good question, but it's not going to happen. Venezuela, you know, is Venezuela. You know, it's not going to happen. Africa is Africa. It's a different place. And why the Chinese, you know, I don't understand your problem with the Chinese naval base. China... I don't know if you understand that the world is changing. You know, the post-World War II situation of the United States as the top dog in the world is not sustainable throughout the future. The United States is becoming more equalized with other countries, including China, and there's this concept, the idea of the rise of the rest. In international relations these days, and especially in business and finance, et cetera, that a lot of these countries that were developing countries and third world countries and colonized by Europe, et cetera, are now becoming more like peers to the United States. Certainly China is like that. China, you know, they own like $1 trillion of U.S. debt. I mean, they own $1 trillion of the United States. These people have tremendous amounts of resources these days.
Well, I think it's more in line about $300 billion. But I look at China as being an enemy myself. And really, the United States, factions of the United States helped China to get to where it was today. We've heard these conversations all the time. I want the United States to become the top dog in the world, but I want to stay out of these intra-country factions, like what went on in Afghanistan. That was a total fiasco myself, especially
with
Joe Biden.
I certainly agree with you.
And it's about the oil. It's about the oil there in the Caspian Sea. You could have oil lines going south toward through India to the Indian Sea. Then you got the things there with Ukraine and Russia and so on and so on and so on.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, I just wanted to make that point about the plans that I read of China's proposed.
Right. Well, you're right. This is at the core of the current relational issues between the United States of America and China. You know, we are the big swinging you-know-what in the world with our military after World War II. Well, you know, we we don't have much choice. We cannot operate that way anymore, unless we want, you know, to go to wars and things like that. And I don't think we're—I don't think we have a stomach for war these days. I think we've had too many of them over the last 20 years that have gone nowhere, and that they've just hosed out a lot of resources and tax money in trillions of dollars to Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, yeah. They have, but, you know, there should have been more development for what we depend on China for in the world, rather than what we see now. We got an open border. You're bringing people across the border, all while you got, some people say, as much as 2 million. I know for sure it's about 800,000 blacks in prison. Those issues should have been taken care of there.
No,
if there's going to be any rehabilitation, it should have been on those people that's in prison that's caught up in abject poverty. It's gotten to a point with the education
with
in the United States that it is a national security problem. It is.
Fair enough, yeah.
So anyway, you guys go ahead and have finished.
Well,
like
listen, you brought in some interesting curveballs there, and it was interesting talking with you. And I think, we have to watch China in Africa. It seems to me, and this is not my idea, this has come from other people, that with this rise of the rest and the new globalized world with the internet and all this stuff, that there is a new, put it this way, a new colonialism, a new imperialism competition going on in the world. I mean, there was a time of European colonialism back in the 17th, 18th, 19th century and whatnot, sort of ended with World War II. And then we had American imperialism, replacing colonialism, if you will, strong-arming a lot of people around the world and exploiting them in a colonial fashion, but a little different. Well, now it's going to be a little different yet. But you have, Russia still around and have ambitions. They have China, the United States. And again, there's Africa, which is one of the richest continents on the world, obviously. And so the Chinese have, they're bursting at the seams, and they're reaching out. Like the United States was bursting at the seams after the Civil War, and so it expanded. It was just so full of itself that it expanded, with Teddy Roosevelt and imperialism in the Philippines, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that's happening now with China. They're just bursting at the seams. They're so wealthy. I mean, they're building cities that they aren't even peopling with people. They just have so much going for them that they're expanding. And one natural place for them to expand for development in roads and dams and bridges, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to make friends in a colonial sort of way, I suppose, is Africa. And, they're on a rise while we're on a decline.
And that's a problem. Care much for Hillary Clinton.
It's a fact.
Well, yeah, it's a factual problem. I'm no fan of Hillary Clinton, but she did make one statement to the president of Zambia talking about the recolonization of Africa, being that China is making such an impulse there.
Right.
And it's not really an up-and-up impulse. They're building things they can't pay for. Then, of course, the Chinese government take control of it for a number of years until it is paid for.
Hey, one of the things in the problems in the world today is corruption. Corruption is real. I mean, I'm of the view that when the doctor slaps you on the ass, you take the first breath. That's where the fight between innocence and corruption starts, And now with the globalization and so much money in the world, of course the Chinese are corrupt. We're corrupt. I mean, come on. It's a mess.
Yeah,
the world's
right.
A goddamn mess, man. Yeah.
Yeah, but who's the corruption going to benefit? I think I'd rather deal with the corruption that's going to benefit Americans than benefiting Chinese, I feel.
It's going to benefit the powerful, except, one thing going on right now in China, if you read the Times and things like that, is Xi they have been having some big powwows over there, and they are really cutting down and actually on corruption and excesses of billionaires and trillionaires and all this kind of stuff in China. And they are actually returning somewhat to, you know, what they would call communist times, where they're much interested in the masses, if you will.
The thing is that I said that they're going to do. Look at the military buildup that they've got. Look at the missile silos that they're putting in. Look at the mobile transport missiles they put in. Look at what they're doing in outer space with the shooting down the satellites.
You're talking about China or what?
China, yes.
Well, I mean, they're not fools. They've watched how the United States has crushed people that have, you know, countries that have stood up and, you know, tried to act independently. And so, of course, they're armed. This is a dangerous world. It's dangerous for them. It's dangerous for us. They're armed to the teeth, and they're arming more and more because, you know, they know how we operate. And so my point is we have to deal diplomatically with all this stuff.
Yeah, we should. But the United States at our present time, our defense and deterrence system is very, very in deplorable conditions. We have to continue to put – we have all these social issues that the Democrats is passing, Build Back Better and infrastructure bill. You only 10% of that is going actually to bridges and roads.
Right,
That's not the way to be. And as I said before, leaving that southern border open is yet still another major security issue. Our educational system, especially in urban areas, is a security issue, and we can see it playing out.
Listen, my friend, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I dealt with the Philadelphia inner cities and whatnot for many years. And the education system inside inner city Philadelphia is embarrassing. It's shameful. It's an atrocity. We need to invest in education like we never have. And we're doing some of that with this Biden bills. But we'll see. We'll see what they do. You're right. It's a problem. Yeah. I agree with you.
You guys go ahead and carry on. Seems like you was having fun before I stepped in.
Never mind me.
I'll talk to you later. Absolutely.
Yeah. Good to hear from you, Piaki. That was Piaki. That's how I pronounce his name. So.
He's got a vantage point that's interesting, you know. But I think China is a fact of life. It's not going to go away. And they're bursting at the seams, as I said, like the United States was bursting at the seams before the 20th century arrived. And when you're bursting at the seams like that, you expand. You go into other places that needs development. And Africa's welcoming that right now. And, so we're scared shitless that, oh, my God. You know, the Chinese are going to get in bed with the Africans and they'll be all against us, you know, and, who knows? I think we need to be smart. We need to be smart. We need to recognize our history and we need to, take care of our own domestic problems like education, poverty, things like that. We need to do more. And infrastructure, we've dropped the ball on a lot of that. And so it's happening, but it's all obviously controversial, and, we could talk about it on the radio for hours, I guess,
Well, the caller, there's others on the line that they – something I noticed today, the network has a switchboard. On the switchboard, when a caller calls in, if they punch one, instead of it used to be just a little blue dot on my screen, and I would like, oh, that guy or that person wants to get online. Well, now they have a little hand.
Oh,
it's a little like a little cartoon, a little hand that pops up when you punch one, listeners.
All right,
and I see a little hand. It's waving. It says, "I want to get on air." So punch one if you're
quick.
No, I'm serious. Yeah, you never know what you come into at Blog Talk Radio.
I tell you,
I'll tell you that.
A sophisticated show. Man.
Well, they let us get away.
Well,
with everything.
Hey, maybe we should talk
murder.
About your latest blue book, your little blue book.
Oh, we've only got 6 minutes. Maybe we should. Well, we can.
Well,
listeners,
is that? Are you calling that discomfort, or is it?
Oh no.
Okay, this is
no,
a special edition.
Gonna,
well, it.
Yeah,
I just received it. It's I don't know how many pages. But it's Adolph Reed, is that correct? Adolph Reed Jr.?
Yeah, Adolph Reed Jr., who is another.
Who is a University of Pennsylvania professor, African-American.
Is it the water?
Hmm?
Is it the water? I mean, is it the water in Pennsylvania that,
could
that
be.
Brings
yeah,
out
yeah.
the...
But it's a wonderful essay, and it's kind of radical. It's thoughtful. It should get discussion going, and so I love it. I got it yesterday, and I'm third of the way through it. I got to finish it today, and you know he's writing about the politics of our time, which are very volatile, as this gentleman who we just spoke with would understand, and you know. It's a wonderful little, and it's in the spirit of, describe the little blue books. What were they? It's very interesting.
In two minutes.
Yeah.
The little blue book was, I'm trying to look for the number. It was, at one point in Girard, Kansas.
Right.
Around the in the early 1900s, a newspaper, the largest socialist newspaper in the United States, in the history of the United States, well, it's called The Appeal to Reason, was printed out of a little town called Girard, Kansas. Still exists, the Girard, Kansas does. The Appeal to
what
Reason.
What corner of Kansas is Girard in?
That would be southeast. That's southeast
okay.
Kansas, down near where I was raised in Leroy, which is.
So you're northeast
and
southeast.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. And it became the newspaper shut down. It was viciously crushed during World War One.
Right.
And afterwards, around 1919, the owner started a thing called they were called People's Pocket Series.
Right.
And there were small booklets that were printed.
Stapled
that you could
together, I guess,
pictures.
Right? Yeah.
Stapled together, just like the crap, just like the stuff I produce. and what was amazing about this little thing is he was cranking out at one point 40,000 of these a day.
Wow.
40,000 copies a day.
On all sorts of topics, almost like TED Talks today, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I think they were better than TED Talks. Actually.
Yeah, well, you know,
and,
just as a metaphor to understand it. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm of this opinion, listeners, and John well knows this, that the internet is nothing. It's a fleeting light that goes past your face and doesn't really get into your brain enough where you can really learn anything out of it.
Right.
You have to really sit there, and most people don't. They don't sit there. They just click,
right,
click,
it's
click,
too,
click,
it's too
click.
Volatile to really absorb for. Yeah.
You got to. Yeah, I mean, my batteries are running out. So, but this book, they became the little blue books, and they're over 500 million of them were sold by the 1950s. Now, I did not know it went on the booklet sold on into the 60s, but I didn't know that. But 2,300 titles, 2,300 different titles.
Amazing.
Different little books, blue books, all out of little Girard, Kansas. And it was to this
right,
day,
and intended
eBay,
to disseminate sophisticated, interesting, complex information to the masses, if you will. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, the owner back then, Haldeman Julius or Julius Haldeman, was from Philadelphia. We'll put that in. He's from another Pennsylvania. He drank the water.
Right. As Adolph Reed, you're the guy's essay.
Yeah, I guess.
From Pennsylvania, Philadelphia. So this Philadelphia Kansas connection is real.
It is. Something to it, maybe, huh? You think?
Yeah, I like it. Yeah.
Well,
right.
The blue books, and we the first one came out, and you're welcome. You can get the address off. You'll know how to get the address, listeners. And thanks
excellent,
for calling
excellent
in,
piece.
John.
Yeah. Good show.
Thank
Take
you,
care,
John.
Mike.
All right, brother.